were so very, very abrasive at that time that I think that affected everyone. They insulted you. The remarks that have appeared recently here and things are minor compared to what would be said in the class.
Was that part of, was that characteristic, or was it unique to Michigan at that time? Was it something that was part of getting an engineering education? Was there some kind of...
This I do not know, but it was part of chemical engineering at this time, and it, I think, had something to do with the personalities of that group of people. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea whether the same thing was true at MIT or someplace else at the time or not. I have a suspicion it was.
Did you find that when you came back as a graduate student that they were still like that, or had they mellowed?
The people had, their turnover had resulted in their mellowing. But Badger, in particular, was famous for his insulting remarks to everyone. Mm-hmm. And this occurred in my classes with Faust and others.
Did they ever turn their ire on you to any incidents you care to relate?
Not on me particularly, but if they called on you and you didn't know, you had to take a lot of abuse. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it couched in terms of, you know, God help us if you design a plant and you don't know this answer, or was it just...
Well, they would say, you poor fool, what are you doing here, and that kind of thing. And if you're not going to do this, why are you wasting my time? And this kind of thing. And it was a fairly typical of a group of people who were there, around among them. When I returned as a graduate student the first day, I had gone to get concert tickets, and I walked in perhaps 2 minutes late into Brown's class, and there were 100 people in the room going through cards. And he said, "Churchill." I said, "Here." He said, "What's the second law of thermodynamics?" And I did not sit down for the entire hour. He and I had a dialogue, and I started to take off my coat. He said, "Don't take off your coat, because if you don't answer this question, you can leave." And we just sat there like this, and I sort of came out okay. He never called on me again the entire year. He did this, then the next day he would pick on somebody else all day. Of course, you never knew what somebody had. And that was his style, and I think many of the people in the department had that style.
Trial by fire. And I did that. Before we move on, I just had two other questions. How large was the department this time in terms of faculty and students? I mean, that was a few years later, you said there were 100 people in a thermo class. But
there were roughly 100 people in my graduating class. Mm-hmm. That included metallurgical engineers who were not identifiably distinct. Mm-hmm. And there were perhaps 25 faculty members, including these people in metallurgy.
Well, Michigan must have been one of the largest departments at the time.
I suspect.
Did it have a distinguished reputation at the time?
I think Baylor thought they were one of the top two or three schools in the country. As an undergraduate, you don't have much perspective on this. I think that's a fair rating probably at that time.
And one other question about the war. You mentioned that White was spending time in Washington doing some war-related work. Did the other faculty get involved in various aspects of it?
Many of them left. House people left home during the spring semester, I think, that year. Breyer, my lady and my doctor, left that year and came in also opening around and found this. Way off and on during this period. I believe that almost all of them, the senior faculty, were either absent or only partially there. They developed a large core of young people who were graduate students who sort of maintained the fort during that period.
And, we'll ask you which of them came back. Presumably a number of them did stay on after the war.
Yes, many.
One was still at Michigan in that transition from
the industrial experience. Did the publication of your paper help you in your obtaining a position at Shell Oil?
It did not. In fact, it may have had a negative influence. When I went to Shell and asked permission, which Cass said I should do, they say in the bottom, presently with Shell Oil, they refused, unless they reviewed the paper. And I wrote to Cass and he said, "Nonsense, it's none of their business," so he did not say Shell Oil on that.
So you were at Shell already when that came out in August. What did you start Shell
immediately after graduation?
Yes, in May, running hard from the draft.
I see. That's the wrong way to put it. Was it difficult to find a position at that point, or were there a lot of openings?
That was just exactly the cliff in which there were no jobs, in which when you went into an interview, everybody offered you a job.
Hmm.
So I think every interviewer that I went to offered me a job on the spot.
Really?
All the students, almost. The only decision was to find out whether there was any chance that you were getting deferred if you took that job, otherwise it wasn't worth your time.
I see.
That was a very hard question to get an honest answer to.
So this job assured you of the deferment then was considered war related.
The position did not assure me of deferment. It was a high probability that it would have. And it turned out to be.
Where else did you interview? Recall.
I didn't interview any place. All the interviewers came there. And I don't remember. I talked with Wyandotte Chemical. I talked with Upjohn. I talked with Allied Chemical, I believe. I may have interviewed only four or five companies. Shell was the first, and I immediately became attracted to that offer. Katz, when I was working, thought that would be a very good place to work.
I assume that it had something to do with the fact that you've been working on questions related to the sort of thing you were doing with Shell. And
Most of the Michigan faculty were working on something related to the petroleum industry, particularly Katz and Brown and these people. So you almost gained the impression that that's what chemical engineering was about.
Can you give some description of the position you had at Shell?
When I first went there, I was assigned to the experimental laboratory, which did hurry-up research over the weekend sometimes. There's something is happening in the refinery, we must find out why. So you either went out there and took samples and did things, or you set up experiments to try to do things. And so I worked on a wide variety of jobs for the first year I was there, usually of a very short nature of that kind. I was then assigned, Shell was building the second catalytic cracker ever built. And it was decided that I and three others would run the pilot plant, and so we were sent down to Houston, where they already had a pilot plant. And I worked there for several months studying what they were doing with that pilot plant. Then came back and started up the pilot plant at Wood River, and then worked on the commercial plant, and it started up almost immediately.
Was that right after you started, or what time?
It was a year. It was a year after I started.
So you did 43?
Yes.
Was there a lot of atmosphere, a lot of pressure to get this plant up and running and to get the pipeline flowing, as it were?
There was tremendous pressure because it's producing aviation gasoline. It was an exciting time. Sometimes it wore on you, but everything always had a great priority to get something done, and there was great pressure to do it from everyone, and you also felt sort of patriotic as well. It wasn't some, a manufactured necessity.
Given the circumstances, and especially you feel that your education in Michigan gave you the top training for this sort of endeavor, but you feel that you were learning on the job.
Well, of course you're learning on the job. But I thought I was as well prepared as other people and did not feel the deficiency of preparation, except that that may have been a persuasive factor in ultimately deciding to go to graduate school. I always felt I didn't know enough about these things, and no one else seemed to either, except a few of the PhDs who were working there, who obviously understood a great deal more about this.
How many people, at least another thing I would ask, but how many people were in the group that you were working in at Wood River, and what kind of background did they have? I mean, what kind of team did Shell have to do this work on the catalytic cracker?
There probably were dozens, if not hundreds, of chemical engineers.
The same level that you were at.
Same level that I was at. But also felt, in many ways, quite competitive with all of these people. Mm-hmm. It was clear that we were always in a training and observing ground. Shell used to give us tests, regular written tests on things. We used to have things to study and take tests. And it was quite clear that it was sort of a grading process going on, where you never quite knew where you stood in any of this. But I know in the assignments that you got, you realized you had done the right thing and the wrong thing in the last job.
Who was supervising your work? You mentioned there 100 or so people with your sort of level of education.
This change considerably. I remember all the people who were supervisor. My first supervisor was John Hartness, who was a PhD chemist from Harvard. Then I worked for Stan Meisenberg, who was a PhD chemical engineer from Michigan, who was the vice president in charge of the assistant superintendent. So, the superintendent in charge of cracking, he actually succeeded somebody else. Then when I switched to the gas plant, I was working for a man named Molson, and I discovered only had a Bachelor of Arts. He didn't study chemical engineering, but I was impressed with how I self-studied here. This is a very peculiar time. There were no chemical engineers at Shell 3 years before I went there. They'd not hired anybody for 10 years. And all of a sudden, they hired hundreds of chemical engineers fresh out of school. So there's nobody in front of you, as I say, speaking.
these two or three people I spoke with, two of you people, who got PhDs in the mid-30s and went to work for the majors or something like that. And then,
you mentioned the sense of competition of the incoming class. In what was, first of all, shallow competitive as far as salary goes? Do you remember how much you were paid at the time?
I started working $150 a month. And a number of us were curious to find that they hired people at $170 a month 6 months later and did not give us a raise. And their argument was that this was frozen because of the war. Categories.
Did the test for the competition of shipping assignments all that eventually
lead to regular raises? And I mean, what I'm trying to get at was, did technical achievement help you to advance, or was
Oh yes. I never got out of the range of Shell, whereby technical achievement was recognized, and I kept getting better jobs and kept getting better salary. And although I don't think we were overwhelmingly paid, I don't think that was a big factor in any of our lives. And when I speak of this competitive feeling, it's clear that Shell created this, but these were all good friends of mine. I drank beer and played golf and did things with all these people I worked with. And during the pilot plant days, we worked on shift work, so it was a hard time socially because in the whole area, we were the only young men around. And therefore, people said nasty things to you and things, why aren't you in the Army? And listen, to go out and play golf or do something like that attracted a great deal of attention. And we had gasoline because we drove back and forth and nobody else did. It was an unusual time.
Who else worked with you on the pilot project? I mean, there must have been a smaller group of you who worked closely together.
Yes, I know them all to this day. Most of them are still at Shell. Mm-hmm. Most of them are either, one is the vice president of Shell, one just retired last year, and the other was superintendent of the refinery. They all did very well at Shell.
What were their names, just for the record?
Ray Schneider, Donald Miller, and Harry Walker, the vice president, Ed Hanudel.
And that, working on that, well, you mentioned the work on that project, and your sense that you felt you could have known more, and nobody else seemed to know what was going on, which you also mentioned the supervisor had a PhD in chemical engineering. Well, at that time, PhDs in chemical engineering must have been relatively scarce, and I just wondered if you had any thoughts from the time about.
Well, I was just so inspired by these people, and they obviously knew so much more about these things than I hardly knew existed. And so I think that was a very inspirational thing. I didn't feel jealous of them or something. I just wanted to emulate them.
In addition to the inspiration, you know, working under this person with a PhD, which may have influenced your time in Michigan for advanced studies, what else did you get from your job, or what effect did your job have on your later formation as a chemical engineer?
I think it had a very profound and lasting effect to this day. I had a wide variety of experiences and a great deal more responsibilities than probably any engineer would have at any other time, because they were forced to load upon us the responsibility that in normal times people with 10 or 15 years of experience would have. And, you know, just, if you're thrown into that kind of fray, you benefit from it. So I think it influences my teaching and my self-confidence to this day. And this kind of sense of urgency and being pushed more rapidly in other jobs. The joke was, every time you did something well at Shell and just got on top of things, they switched you to a completely different area of the refinery or plant and threw you in over your head there. So you battled out there. And I don't think that goes on now simply because there are more people around and the movement is not as high. Did you find the atmosphere different at Shell? I mean, the professor in the Michigan or fashion quite a bit of that there.
They were that may have been the answer to your question.
They were fellows at that same time, too. I can remember having only been at Shell a year and being in a room with two vice presidents and somebody else and having them abusing me and others supporting me because of an argument over something in the cat record. So that was a great winning factor. I was right, and some people in the room recognized it. And they said, do not let these other people intimidate you. They ought to know better. You're right, and they're wrong. You know, I don't want to get into that level of spite. I think that, I didn't at the time, but I think that was a lucky thing. I've always had feeling all my life from being very lucky circumstances. I think those were
And the plant consists of 2 units each of 15,000 barrels a day. So that may have been
have been the largest scale-up in history. Yeah.
There must have been a few problems connected with that scale-up.
There were nightmares, but it ran. Mm-hmm. And they were under-instrumented and everything because everybody was trying to minimize. It's just a miracle, I suppose. That they're still running today.
Really? Do you know if the shell was working in conjunction with other ones? Because I understand it was in a lot of work.
Oh yes. That project was joint with some group called CRM or something, and it was a group that shared knowledge on catalytic cracking. And they basically built that with the Exxon process. Exxon ran 100 barrel a day semi-works plant, and I think had started one cat cracker before Shell. But although they cooperated, there was also a degree of trying to do it our way and not let them know. So that
did you interact with people from another company or something?
I did not, although one of my colleagues was the liaison that went to these meetings with Exxon and the other people.
Yeah, was it you suggested that Shell was going to develop some proprietary knowledge out of the animal? Was there a lot of positioning going on for that after the war when this kind of cooperation was unlikely to last?
I think so. I think that Shell was always looking at how can we take what we wanted to Standard Oil in Indiana, New Jersey, Exxon's process and improve it so that we will have a better operation than they had. They were, however, obviously legally forced to share all that information. And in fact, there were also the construction companies that were an intermediate here, and there was also the attempt not to let them know how you were improving the process, so they would not carry that on to your competitor and building your improvements in their next plants.
Did the federal government, they say, what was going on at Shell, or specifically Shell, or the programs and the funding?
As far as I know, it was all funding. The federal government acted as the central clearinghouse for petroleum. Of the war, so I think that encourages people to share this knowledge and incentivize them to have antitrust action in so doing. We had other government interactions. I worked shortly, perhaps even that first year, on developing an anti-rust compound that went into turbine oil, which has been said to be a factor in World War II. Our ships stayed at sea forever, and the usual reason for everything is corrosion of bearings, and that is because you get salt water in the fuel oil, and eventually this corrosion of bearings of the turbines, so they have to come into your trip. Somebody at Shell discovered a compound which prevented it. And so Shell got a contract with the government to make this, and all they had was the laboratory, so they made it in the laboratory. And they had started to build, when I arrived, a pilot plant to study making this. And I was told in the laboratory to see if I could improve the process. And I found a different way of doing it, which made about 100 times as much as they were making it. So the pilot plant ran the whole free world. Forever. They never built the other plant, but there were great problems with the government over this because they had contracted with the government to produce so many barrels a day of this, and it was clear that one part in a thousand of this didn't work, and Shell struggled through the war trying to get that specification changed and never did, so we cheated. We put one drop in a barrel and sold it, and they couldn't tell the difference. And we were meeting the specification, but I think everybody thought the government is so stupid that they will not. Shell is not trying to beat anybody out of money or anything. It's just nonsense to make 1,000 parts of setting when you only needed one. What we did is we purified materials, and we found that little ingredient. But the business, which had not been discovered at the time, it was successful.
What was that compound?
It was a condensation product of C18 alcohol and acetic anhydride. I'm sorry, maleic anhydride. And it's hydrophobic on one end and hydrophilic on the other, so it makes a film around all of the water drop in the oil, and so they never contact the surface. It only takes us 2 minutes.
Did you have experienced that issue when you prepared the sort of work? Was that something you knew? You said you were killing yourself on this, and probably didn't think that was
yourself. I don't think so. The good part of re-education in Michigan, when you were comparing today, is that there was a great deal of reinforcement. What we learned, we really learned to do. We could design a distillation column for a filter, and every student in the class knew we could do this, and it would work. And in the laboratory, we were thrown out with pieces of machinery and said, go get some data, and nobody helped. And so we got kind of good at putting things together with baling wire and doing this. And I think, although it was very frustrating, it also built sort of a confidence that you could do things. We did not run hand experiments. And I think both of those things helped in the long run.
Was that, did you have colleagues at Shell who come from MIT, from Minnesota, other programs who had different experiences?
Yes, well, I don't know that I can remember what schools all had different experiences, but they had quite different chemical engineering backgrounds, and they knew more about some things than I did. I think I found generally that their chemistry was better, and I knew more mathematics than I did then. And they, most of them had not had that sort of in the laboratory on your own type feeling.
So I think those were helpful things, but I think most of them had an adequate preparation.
I believe you started as a technical assistant for the petroleum refining portion of Shell Oil and Wood River. Did you accumulate other titles as time went on until you advanced?
I think I was called a junior technologist and then a technologist. But during this period, they first called us junior technologists, and then they decided it would sound better to the federal government when they were trying to get us deferments that they called us technologists. And that caused some rallying because this is a title that's a fairly senior title in Shell. But so none of us were overly impressed to have that title because we knew it was for external purposes. But titles were not a big thing at Shell. I had no feeling that it made any difference what my title was.
What then, what made you move on from Shell in 1946? I had been thinking for some time that I did not want to do the rest of my life what I was doing there, and that I didn't see anybody from my background at Shell doing anything I wanted to do with the rest of my career. The ultimate there would have been to spend the rest of one's life in that refinery or another refinery. And Shell was a very paternalistic company. If you became the superintendent of the refinery, you delivered inside the refinery gates. So every time the alarm went off or anything, you got out of bed and out. And to me, this involved a commitment of one's what I saw the people who were, in my 20 years, who were the top people that I might aspire to be, who were spending 16 hours of their day, 7 days a week, always, at least if they weren't working for Shell, they were on call. And then you met them, and I was just like, that's not my work. Why did you just direct it? Not yet. They, one of my colleagues at Shell, can be the one who performed that liaison function for with the other oil companies for Cat Cracking. His name is Chris Cannon. In conjunction with two of his college classmates, started a new chemical plant. And the war had ended, and therefore I was free to go, and I had been thinking about the possibility of going back to graduate school. And he called and persuaded me to get a raise to go to work and start this new enterprise, and promised me that after a year, they would make me a stockholder in the company, and I would become part of management in the company. And it looked like that. Tom Thompson, I liked him very well, and he sounded adventurous, and so it did. What did you do there at Patrick Chemical, which I believe was Denver City, Texas?
Yes, it was Denver City, Texas. Which is, it was the end of the earth. I had no idea. There was not a tree to be seen 200 miles. Anyway, it was in the middle of almost the desert, in the high plains of West Texas. We started up electric chemical plant. These people, the friends of my friends, were in oil well acidizing business. Which, and they took hydrochloric acid and put down oil wells in order to improve the flow of oil. And they bought the acid from Dow, who was their competitor in providing acidizing service. So that occasionally they had trouble obtaining delivery of the oil, of the acid.
Yes.
So they decided perhaps they should either manufacture the acid themselves, they threatened to. So they persuaded this fellow at Shell to look into this process. He left Shell a year earlier, and he decided to be economical for them to make their own acid. And so then he went down to start the plant. He avoided all the equipment for the plant. And I went to the plant. The buildings were there, but that's all.
But the plant had been designed?
The plant had been designed on paper.
And a lot of it was being delivered. It was being piled up there. And I went down as the only engineer there, except for another fellow from Shell who was a maintenance. And he was not a professional engineer, but quite very tight.
And I had known vaguely at Shell. So they looked like kind of trouble. There, all these people were cotton pickers or cowboys. They had never been near any other kind of job. The cotton market was so bad that they were like, "Hey, they got that back." And they had to get the back.
Water, and we took that water and turned and pumped it back down into the ground into the salt bed.
we treated the brine with calcium carbonate and caustic soda, both of which we made. And then the treated brine went into a hooker, electrochemical cells, like a current was passed through the cells, making chlorine and hydrogen and caustic soda with caustic soda. Everyone else saw the farm. And that person was adding hydrogen, but we burned the hydrogen in the farm. And they had a lot of acid. So then I absorbed that, and then we also evaporated the water out of the caustic soda, and so caustic soda used part of that for treating and took CO2 off our stack gas. And we used that with caustic soda to make calcium carbonate for aerial drying. And we used it in the middle of the natural gas field. And we bought off gas for almost nothing. And we generated electricity. And we ran gas-driven compressors. Gas-driven compressors to generate electricity, I should have said. And that's what we ran the cells on. So we had no raw material entering our tanks at all, except the cells themselves, which we bought for cookers. And we trucked all the products within a 50-mile range of our plant. So it was just phenomenally profitable.
Yeah. The nearest caustic soda plant was at Freeport, Texas, Dow, 800 miles away. The freight was more than our cost of manufacture. The nearest hydrochloric acid plant was in Dallas, which is 400 miles away, and that's 80% water. So these companies just gave up, and we suddenly had the whole West Texas. We could not make enough product to sell. I think we totally underestimated.
Okay, so how large was it?
I cannot remember in tons. We had originally 16, eventually 32 cells. The word was from Hooker we had to have 600 cells to be minimally profitable. But they eventually realized they never made profit. And that plant was supposed on paper to pay out in 6 months. But because of some difficulties, it took 11 months to pay out.
Still phenomenal.
It's just absolutely phenomenal. And we sold brine, which we could have made, shut the plant down, only sold the brine. Because the water was so hard and it was used for regenerating the zeolite treaters, and Culligan would come up and buy our brine in trucks and do it. Why would they drill a well? They could never have afforded the cost of drilling the well and so forth would have been probably excessive for that.
So, well, that explains why Frontier Chemical is in the middle of nowhere.
That's why
it was an astute choice.
Like a smashing success. Did Kurtz and live up to his promise to make you guys better?
No. after 6 months, he and the two partners sold out. They were millions, instant millionaires. They had invested $25,000, and I think they sold the plant for around $4 million. And Curtis Cannon retired at 40 or something like this. The other fellow is Eddie Childs, who now owns the Dallas, not the Cowboys, but the baseball team in Texas.
But he's the Astros.
Yeah. And I've forgotten the other is head of the Republic National Bank in Texas. They were. Actually, they became millionaires independently also because by acidizing the oil wells, they kept track of where all the successful wells were, and so they always bought perfectly land. And they ended up owning all of the land that came in the oil wells there. They became two of the richest men in West Texas.
How did you get
them? They sold out, and I was left with Murchison, who bought this, and as an investment, and I was just an employee. And then O'Connor's left for me. Yeah. He bought it. It became part of Open Materials. And so I decided there wasn't, I mean, I was not forced to leave, but I could see no future there, and that's when I came back to graduate school.
So how was the atmosphere, though, at Frontier? Must have been, before the sellout, must have been gratifying, and it was such a success.
I mean, it was gratifying, but I was right back in the same place that I was in Shell, because there was nobody to turn to, therefore it was a 24-hour job. We drove 24 miles to Seagraves to get a phone call and go back and spend the night there, and we blew up the plant once. We had our adventures, but the place was just lousy with rattlesnakes. We had rattlesnakes in our office. This was out in the real the West. So I don't know what would have happened at Kansas City.
How large an operation was it?
How many people were there relative to what you've been doing in Shell? Was it 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people?
Well, all told, there might have been 25 people.
Oh.
Counting all the operators, secretaries, accountants, and it was a very small-scale operation. They eventually went on and built quite a few, expanded that plant and built several other plants at the same time.
Were you tempted to try to get some venture capital and repeat the operation somewhere else?
No, exactly the opposite. I saw what had happened to Cannon, who had been a very nice person, very relaxed and brilliant, and tremendous, had become almost totally neurotic because of the pressure of making that operation go. I mean, for a long time, it was very catch and go. We had people waiting for this, the plant's not running, and I realized that, I mean, he did not change his relationship with me, but